And so welcome to this day-long retreat on mindfulness of the body. And mindfulness of the body is one of the foundation pieces, most important foundation piece, I would say, to the Buddha's practice of mindfulness. In a sense, a lot of the work of mindfulness is the work of the mind. And we're developing certain qualities of mind, and we're developing certain capacities of mind, certain possibilities and potentials in the mind. The mind's ability to pay attention, for one, the mind's ability to apply itself in paying attention, the mind's ability to get concentrated, the mind's ability to be discerning and discriminating by what it sees, to see clearly. And so there's a lot of mental things that are being developed with mindfulness practice. And however, the body itself doesn't have the same kind of volitional role in our lives as the mind does. The body doesn't in the same way kind of choose to pay attention. The body doesn't choose what qualities it wants to develop. The body in some kind of way is a more passive quality of our psyche compared, or our psychophysical being compared to the mind. The mind is really the pilot for the practice. But having said that, it's very important not to think that the practice is only about the mind. Probably one of the most important foundations for mindfulness practice is the experience of the body, being in the body. And to make too sharp a separation between the mind and the body is not done in the Buddhist tradition. They're kind of seen as being kind of not exactly separate, not exactly different, but somehow a combination of both. And you find a lot, the Buddha teaching a lot about the importance of the body, importance of mindfulness of the body. And he said things like, there is no cultivating the mind, there's no training of the mind without cultivating the body, with the mindfulness of the body. There is no experience of liberation without cultivating a strong sense of presence in the body. One of my favorite quotes is a quote from after the Buddha died. Soon after he died, a person came to Ananda. Ananda was the Buddha's most senior disciple, one of his most senior disciples, and a right-hand attendant for many, many decades, and knew the Buddha quite well, and was the carrier of... He had a tremendous ability to memorize. So he had memorized much of the Buddha's teachings over the years that he was his attendant. And after the Buddha died, he was the one then who passed those teachings on to the other monks who memorized them and kind of created the canon of the Buddha's teachings. So Ananda was a very important person in the tradition. And someone came to the Buddha, to Ananda, and said, now that the Buddha is dead, who can be our best friend? So that's, thinking of the Buddha as your best friend is a nice expression. So rather than saying, who can be our guru, he said, who can be our best friend? And a different kind of flavor in the relationship. And so Ananda said, oh. And the expectation of the guy was that maybe the Buddha had appointed someone to be the successor and some person who can kind of take over. And Ananda's reply was, oh, now that Buddha has passed away, mindfulness of the body can be your best friend. And I think that's a remarkable statement over many different points of view. The Buddha, in fact, refused to appoint someone as being a successor. In a sense, he appointed the Dharma as being his successor. He felt that he had disseminated the Dharma well enough. But to call your body your best friend, to have that kind of relationship to your body, like your body has that kind of close, intimate relationship, or that kind of maybe feeling of warmth or connectedness, or what is it like to have a best friend, someone who advises you and helps you, is there for you in times of trouble and times of joy, someone who can guide you when you're a little bit misplaced, someone who you feel really close to. And to your body to have all those roles. To call the Buddha the best friend, he was, partly because he was the teacher. And can your body be your own teacher? The body is a teacher. And the body is a friend. It's a place we can feel at home in as opposed to feeling alienated from or separated from or averse to. At the same time, in the Buddhist tradition, there tends not to be the same level of celebrating the body that you might find in some areas, especially in the modern world, where people want to kind of, some pagan religions, for example, probably for very good reasons, want to celebrate the body as the temple. And going to that extreme is also not, you know, I haven't seen that too often in the Buddhist tradition. There's a tremendous appreciation for the importance of mindfulness of the body, but it's not overdone. It's not like the body is given some great value in and of itself. The expression always in the tradition is that the mindfulness of the body is what's important. It's mindfulness of the body which is your best friend. It's not just your body. So there's a distinction there. It's your ability to bring mindfulness to the body which is important. And the body then becomes the domain, the field in which you practice mindfulness. So in many Buddhist traditions that I've had contact with, there in various ways, getting into the body, being with the body, being connected to the body as the body is doing activities and as the body is in meditation, is one of the primary vehicles for developing wisdom and many of the qualities that come with practice: freedom, liberation, compassion. So the body is very important in the Buddhist tradition, and mindfulness of the body is very important. And that's what we'll do today, is we'll kind of devote the day to this domain, this field of experience. And in talking about mindfulness of the body, it might be helpful to distinguish between objective experience and subjective experience. And these are kind of vague words, and I'll define them so, you know, according to my uses here today. There's a lot of objective things happen to our body, to our experience, to our life. And some of them are not in our control, and some of them are. So there might be some very loud car that drives by, or motorcycle. We have some amazing motorcycles in the neighborhood here. And so it's kind of like not our control exactly. I mean, we could move the center, I suppose, but that's not so easy. And so here, this is what happens. And objectively, there's a cause to us hearing this very loud motorcycle rumbling down the street, and it's objective cause. You know, it's, you know, objectively, the sound comes our way. And then there's a subjective way in which we experience that. In the subjective world, so, you know, we couldn't, in theory, do something about the objective cause. We could go out there and get the police to come and patrol. We could put barriers in the road. We could petition the city. Then when we have one-day sittings, we block all the streets in the neighborhood. And there's a lot of objective things we could do. And maybe we should do some of those things. I'm not going to say we shouldn't, necessarily, if we use this as a metaphor for other situations. But there's also the subjective way in which we experience that. And so we experience it as, we hear sort of sound, rumbling and shaking, and maybe you hear feel the felt sense quality of that sound in your ears or your head or your body as it goes by. If they drive by with a boom box in addition, you kind of really feel the body kind of shaking a little bit. So there's a physical subjective experience of what that sound is like when it impacts on your body. In addition, there's a whole subjective world of how you react to that. So some of you might be amused, wow, you know. Or some of you might feel, wow, I wonder what, that's a cool motorcycle. I wonder if I should get a Harley. Or some of you might be irritated, how could anybody be so thoughtless to drive around in a motorcycle in the neighborhood with that kind of careless driving without a muffler, you know? Or how could they have chosen the meditation center in this kind of place, this kind of neighborhood? They didn't know better. And, you know, those people. I don't know how to do, you know, this is disturbing my meditation. And I've heard you're supposed to be able, in mindfulness, to open up to all experiences. And I can't seem to open up to it without any irritation. Something's wrong with me. And I'm a failure, and maybe I should join the dolphin club and go swimming instead. So there's all kinds of, you know, subjective reactions Some of them have to do with beliefs and ideas and values that we have. So there's an objective world and there's a subjective world. In the subjective world, I'm dividing into two things: the kind of physical, felt sense experience of the stuff and our reactions to it. The domain of mindfulness is the domain of this subjective world. And when we say in mindfulness, we were developing acceptance of our experience, we're not saying acceptance of the objective world. We're talking about acceptance of that subjective world. The objective world, you might want to do something about. It might be very wise and appropriate to do something about it, depending on what it is, what the situation is. And hopefully you have the wisdom to know when to act to change the objective world, the causes of what impacts you, and when to leave it alone. But the subjective world, so we're not necessarily being asked to accept the objective world. But in practice, we're asked to accept the subjective world within reason. If you need to change something or can change something in the objective world, please go ahead. But in the subjective world, can you cultivate the ability to be attentive to that, to hold that in awareness, with acceptance, with equanimity, with kindness, with the kind of ability that doesn't have to make it go away or to change it? Why would you want to do that? Sometimes you have no choice. Some subjective experiences just are not going to go away. Physical pain, for example. Sometimes physical pain just won't go away. You can't get enough aspirins or medicine to make it go away, or you can't change the conditions, and it's there. Certain situations in life, it doesn't seem appropriate to change the objective world, but rather you want to deal with the subjective world and cultivate the ability for the mind to be equanimous. The mind has a tremendous capacity for being at peace, not being in conflict with its experience. And part of what we're doing is in practicing mindfulness of the body is learning how to develop that capacity of the mind to be at peace with our experience. And so what this does is that our subjective experience has meaning in the Buddhist tradition. It's meaningful for us to either be in pain or have great pleasure. And it's meaningful in the sense that it becomes a locus for us to be engaged in practice, to be engaged in what it's like to discover our capacity to be at peace with that experience. So what we want to do is to directly bring our attention to our physical experience and feel it, get to know it. It's subjective experience. Now, my subjective experience at this moment is I'm very hot. And I'm quite capable of sitting here and accepting that. I've sat in much hotter situations than this, where I got up from my sitting and I was dripping, and there was a ring of water around me when I got up. But I think we can do something about this one. And I wonder if we could turn down. Thank you. So there's an example of, you know, where it's appropriate to do something in the objective world. But maybe the switch is broken. And then we'll just have to work with it. So this objective experience is kind of the domain of practice. And to be able to know how to distinguish between the objective and the subjective world is really important, I think, for understanding where the area of practice is. Now, where is the subjective world? Where does that subjective world exist? Where is it? And it's in a very small area of the world. It's probably, you know, about as high as you are high. It's probably about as wide as you are wide. And it's probably as, you know, broad as you are broad. You know, and maybe sometimes you have a sense it's a little bit beyond that, maybe a couple of inches. But that's the domain. You know, it's not like a, you know, how big is that? You know, 6 square feet? That's the domain. That's the meditational. That's the monastery. That's the monastery in which the subjective world of experience is. So that makes it a lot easier, because now you know where your meditation hall is. That's the world we're getting to know and exploring and developing and connecting with. And so when we practice mindfulness of the body, we're practicing the ability to stay in that world, that square, 6 square feet world or whatever, of your experience, subjective experience, and getting to know it. Now, in the subjective world, there are two kinds of experience, I said. There's that experience which is kind of the felt sense way, the perceptions pick up experience. It feels physical way which we experience things. And then there's our reaction to it, our response to it, the emotions, the beliefs, and all that. And both are very important. Today, we're primarily going to focus on the physicality of our experience, learning how to ground ourselves and stay with that. But our reactive relationship to that subjective world of experience is closely connected. They're kind of intertwined. You can't make a clean separation for them. And as you cultivate mindfulness of the felt sense experience of your body, you're at the same time cultivating, working on, discovering, clarifying, purifying the reactive qualities of the mind. Some of the subjective experiences that we hold in our body that get revealed as we practice have to do with, are there because of past reactions that we've had. If you're chronically afraid or tense, afraid or anxious, that anxiety or stress might be kept in your shoulders. If you go around running around your daily life, not paying much attention to your body, kind of engaged with all the things you have to do, thinking about what you have to do and kind of engaged in activity and in thought, you're not going to notice what's happening in your body, the chronic, the way in which your tension is being held in your body. You sit down to meditate and the holding pattern will reveal itself sooner or later. And so the past subjective reactivity now is being manifested in the subjective felt sense experience in your body. Now, the marvelous thing about this is that if you can bring your attention and hold it in this place of holding in your body, if you can connect there and stay there, it's kind of a lot like getting a massage. What are the qualities of a good masseuse? A masseur? Masseuse. We say masseuse, don't we? But isn't that the feminine? Right? It's maybe a female, but don't we usually say something masseuse nowadays? We say masseur also? Okay, masseuse or masseur. And, you know, what's the qualities of a really good person who massages?
Massage therapist.
You know, I think that probably you want someone who's really present for you, who's really there, who's not kind of daydreaming and wandering off, someone who's really connected to his or her hands, and really feels that they're putting a lot of energy or attention in their hands. And not only are they there for you there, but they're actually kind of feeling and sensing the contours of your body, of your muscles. They find where the tension and the knots are in your body, and they're kind of tracing it and following it and discovering where it is and discovering maybe where the center of it is and learning how to be right there for that kind of, and being a little bit creative perhaps and going around it and under it and various things that the massage therapist might do. There's various qualities of a good massage therapist that you want. What we're asked to do is to do the same thing for ourselves, to have those kind of qualities when we bring our attention to our physical experience of our body. And then a good massage therapist, you know, you don't want them to kind of finally discover where that knot is and then say, and they'll tell you, just a minute now, you know, I think I need to go out and get a smoke. You know, I need to go get some coffee. I'll come back in 10 minutes. And, you know, you don't want that because that's not going to, you know, finally, if they finally found it, you want them to really work on it. But we do that for ourselves all the time, don't we? We finally, you know, connect to something and the mind does the equivalent of going off for a break. It goes off, you know. We want to, probably a masseuse has to develop that capacity of attention as a massage therapist develops their skill. They're also developing their capacity to pay attention, to concentrate. We want to do that for ourselves, develop that capacity over time. And when something happens in our body, to develop the capacity to be there and really sense it and feel it and enter it in the same kind of way that a massage therapist might enter with their hands. We enter with our mind, with our awareness. As we do that, as awareness enters into those parts of our body, any part of our body, you know, the holding places in our body, it works like a massage. If we can enter it carefully enough and feel it directly enough, then It starts to break up. It starts to dissolve. So we start seeing the impermanent nature of it. It has a chance to relax a little bit. It moves. There's a whole different world that opens up when we can enter something quick, easily, and deeply, and massage it with our awareness. So the subjective way in which we react to things is then held sometimes in our body. There's a lot of things which are held in our body. Sometimes it's not because of... sometimes it's not psychological reactions, but maybe it's an illness or some kind of injury we've had. And it's very purifying also to bring very careful attention to that those physical pains also. And rather than kind of necessarily purifying the physical pain, perhaps what we're doing is purifying the mind that reacts to that and relates to that. I would suggest to you that if you're practicing with your body, mindfulness of the body, any bodily experience you have has meaning, is meaningful. It has a purpose. It's useful as a domain of practice. It's not there because, you know, I mean, I don't want to get too metaphysical or too, you know, superstitious or whatever, but because we engage our mindfulness in it, it now has a purpose. If we don't engage ourselves in the mindfulness practice with it, then maybe it has no purpose at all, no usefulness to us. And then we might, you know, some people get depressed because, oh, not again, I feel this thing. But to enter it, bring mindfulness into our experience, and to stay with a subjective experience. So that's probably enough as an introduction for the day, before we do our first meditation. Some of you might be new here. I don't know if you know this place, but there are three bathrooms. Two over there on that side of the building and one upstairs. And if there's no sign saying, no, don't disturb across the stairs, you're welcome to go upstairs to use the bathroom there. The day will be spent alternating between sitting meditation and walking meditation, probably about 35 minutes of each. And I'll give instructions and some guidance during the sittings. During the walking meditation times, during some of them, I'll be available just informally if people have any questions for me about the practice. And since I think it's nice for people to have the ability to do walking meditation in this room, I'll be in that little hall. If I'm in the conference room there, then you can go out. You go through the library to get into it. Then I'll just be there informally. Some of you can come, take turns, come in and talk with me for a few minutes. Don't bring up anything really big that's going to take an hour to talk about. This is not the time for it. Somewhere around 12:30, we'll stop for an hour for lunch. And then probably the end of the day, I'll probably give a talk, unless I feel like I've talked too much through the day. And in which case, maybe we'll just be quiet or do more meditation. We'll end at 4:30. And there's two donation baskets, dana baskets, at the entryway there. And that's for you to decide what to do with. But this, the way in which the spiritual tradition is organized, it's organized to be supported and be motivated in a field of generosity. The field of generosity is kind of one of the fields, the dimensions by which the spiritual tradition moves through. And so the teachings, the opportunity to come to this center is offered in a generous fashion for all of you to come here and use as useful for you. And then we put a basket out there if, in your spirit of generosity, you feel inclined to support what we're doing here to make it possible to continue and move through, you know, into the future. And there's two baskets. One is the basket for operations for the center, for all the things we need to take care of the center and pay for and our expenses. And the other is a teacher basket, which in this case would be for me and for my support. And so if you want to participate in that field of generosity, then those baskets are there. So... logistically, those are the things I have to say. Any questions at this point? Before?
I
Yeah. So during the walking practice meditation, about 5 minutes before the scheduled next scheduled sitting practice, you'll do it? Or someone will go and ring the bell around a little bit outside and inside, so you don't have to keep looking at your watch. You hear the bell and you come back. If you go walking around the neighborhood, then you might have to keep your eye on your watch. And I'll announce at the end of each sitting when the next walking period will be. That's how the schedule works. And in the hallway there, if you can walk crosswise, that's probably the most efficient way of getting the most number of people in that hallway there. And if you walk in here, maybe we should walk this way, because that's maybe the way to get the most people. Well, I don't know, since all of you have your things on the floor, probably that doesn't just work. Walk whatever way it works. And then some people like to walk up there, make some space for one person up there on the stage. And so, seem okay? So now I've been talking for almost half an hour, and you've been sitting that long. I think before we do our first sitting, it'd probably be a good idea if you took a minute to stand and stretched and got the circulation going a little bit. So for standing meditation, you want to have your feet about hip distance from each other. If they're too far apart, some people like form like a really wide base. I think it's actually not so stable. I think you end up using more muscles, even though maybe intuitively it seems like to be stable. You kind of keep them underneath your hips. And close your eyes. And then begin by feeling the contact of your feet against the floor. And you might rock forward and back a little bit and feel how the weight shifts on the soles of your feet as you do that. And then slowly come to a place where the weight is evenly distributed and stand still. It's helpful if you have your knees a little bit loose, so they're not locked. Feel the whole global body. Feel all the movements in your body as you're standing here. And probably as you're, even if you hold yourself somewhat still, you probably find that in order to keep your balance, there's a lot of small movements all over your body. And that's fine. That's the way it should be as you're standing. The stiller you stand, the more subtle the movements are. and let your attention kind of wander around your body as it wants to, but stay in your body. Staying with the subtlety of movement, of tensing up and releasing that happens. Taking a few moments to feel the weight of the body, the pull of gravity on the various parts of your body. Heaviness, shoulders and arms, torso. And as you feel the weight and heaviness and gravity, as you exhale, kind of surrender to that. Yield to it. And also within your body, you can become aware of your breathing. The movements in your body as you breathe. You might have thoughts, reactions to doing standing meditation. Be attentive that you don't get pulled into the world of thinking and reactions. Entrust yourself for a little while with your body. Bringing a sense of presence, discovering a sense of presence within your body. Take a few moments to see if you can discover any vibration or humming or tingling in the body, throughout the whole field of the body or in particular places. you can feel any humming or vibration, make room for it. Allow it to be there. Let it expand if it wants to. And then quietly, mindfully, take your seat. Buddhist spiritual practice often involves pairs of qualities. Meditation is pairing of being relaxed with being attentive, strongly attentive to what's happening. Clear focus. There's a pairing of great acceptance of what's happening, kindness, a kind of lightness. Lightness of being about what's going on, with an intentness, resolve to be engaged moment by moment, not to give up or not to be complacent, but not to be so resolved that you're expecting or demanding that things be a certain way. Kind of a lightness, maybe a playfulness, trying again and again to develop, to strengthen the mind. Strengthens the mind's capacity to be concentrated and focused, mindful. So we'll begin the first sitting with bringing our focus, our intent focus, on the breathing is a subset of our bodily experience, because the breathing is continuous through time. It's a wonderful place to cultivate and develop the capacity of the mind to stay continuous with something in the present moment. So in order to remind yourself to be with the breath, you might take a few deep breaths to connect, to feel it, to remember it. Taking some long, slow, deep breaths. As you exhale, you might relax. And the relaxation is mostly physical, physical relaxation. At the same time, you want to maintain a clarity of mind, an alertness of mind. Letting the breath be normal. What we're interested in here is the physical experience of breathing, how it feels subjectively in the physical sphere. Perhaps you can notice a difference, how the in-breath is different than the out-breath. The physical differences. As you stay with your breathing, you'll notice that there's an alternation of sensations, expansion, contraction. So a whole series of things that change as you breathe in the body. There's a kind of rhythm to breathing in and out. Hang in there with that rhythm of breathing. Hang in there with your breathing. Being intent on discovering and exploring the physical experience of each breath, each in-breath and each out-breath. If your mind gets caught up in thoughts and concerns, you can let go of them. Begin again with the breathing. Sometimes it's helpful to say to your thinking mind, later, I'll think about that later. That sometimes can help put things to rest. So you can be with your breath, trusting it, one breath after the other. As you inhale, especially the second half of the inhalation, you might notice there's some ways in which you can relax, particular ways of relaxing that allows the inhalation to be a little bit more full. Yielding to the process of breathing in, maybe the chest relaxes and expands more, the belly, the diaphragm, the rib cage. And the same thing as you exhale. You might notice, maybe especially at the end of the exhalation, some very simple ways in which you can relax or let go. Some holding in the body or some hurrying with the out-breath, so that the exhalation can be more complete. At the end of the exhalation, let there be a moment or an instant of being at ease in that transition before you breathe in, so the inhalation arises peacefully on its own. Sometimes it's possible to feel the body, a part of the body, as a field of vibration or humming or tingling. And if it's possible to feel it that way, it can change then to feel the breathing, sensations of breathing, as if they're occurring within that field of vibration. Humming, flowing. Can be helpful that while you're staying with your breathing, that you have the attitude that you're going to allow the breathing to have an effect on you. Open to the possibility of the breathing massaging you or calming you. So now we'll do 35 minutes of walking meditation. We'll start the next sitting at 10:50. And as I said, you can walk in here, you can walk in that hall there. And a few people might want to walk, one person perhaps could walk upstairs, in a little room upstairs. Just wherever you feel it works. And also outdoors, the parking lot. If anybody's parked in the parking lot, it actually might be nice if you could move your car so the parking lot is empty for walking meditation out there. And a little garden out here, a space for walking meditation. As those of you who might would like to have instructions in walking meditation. So those who'd like to instructions, you can come and meet me in the little conference room that's right here on the side. Go out into the library and you'll come in. And anybody who'd like to have any kind of instructions or talk about walking meditation, you can come right after this. And one principle I want to pass on to you as you do your walking meditation, the principle is true for other areas of life too, in meditation. And there's an inverse relationship between being caught up in our thoughts and thinking and our ability to sense our body. The more fully you enter into the sensory world of your body, and feel and sense, the quieter the mind will become. And the more fully you enter into the world of your thoughts and conceptual thinking and realms and remembering and planning and all that, the more disconnected you'll be from your physical body. And you might notice this. Is this true for you? Explore that. Those times when you find yourself lost in your thoughts, notice how much you're connected to your body, the degree to which you're connected. And when you're really absorbed in your body and connected to it and really there, notice if your mind correspondingly gets quieter and stiller. Probably it will. And knowing this principle might help guide you into staying more, entering more fully into this realm of the physicality, the physical sensations. So as you do the walking meditation, see if you can enter into the sensory world, enter into the sensate world, enter into the felt sense world of what goes on in the body as you walk, and kind of absorb yourself in that world, lose yourself in that physical felt sensory world, and probably you'll find the mind gets quieter, stiller as it does that, more peaceful. Not always, but there's generally that relationship. So enjoy your walking. Thank you. So an analogy that might work for this practice is someone, an artist who works with clay, makes sculpture or whatever. There's the artist, there's the hands that work the sculpture, the clay, and there's the clay that gets worked on. In a similar way, for practice, the mind is the artist. Attention is the hands that connect and work the material. And the clay, the body is the clay that's explored, that's worked and kneaded and developed. Or the example of a masseuse. There's the massage therapist who has the craft, the skill, the art. There's the hands that do the work, that connect. And then there's the body that's massaged. So in both those situations, for the artist and the masseuse, there's a lot of qualities that get developed, qualities of mind, of heart. But the medium through which those qualities are being developed is the clay or the other person's body. So for us, you know, today the body is the medium that we're exploring. The attention is the hands or the brush or the vehicle through which we do our art. We connect to the medium. And then the mind is the artist. And the mind needs to develop certain qualities, just like the mind of an artist needs to have certain qualities in order to work. Some artists who maybe are brilliant don't think about that. They just do their work. But there's a lot of concentration and focus and attentiveness, mindfulness, sensitivity, and a lot of different qualities you can imagine. Discipline sometimes that go into you know, doing the work. So these three things, the mind, the attention, which is the medium through which the mind communicates or is engaged with its artwork, and the artwork is the body, getting to know the body. So one of the things an artist needs to learn is to really understand well the material it's working with, really get in there and explore it and get to know its qualities and textures and feelings and everything about it. And so it's very helpful to become really familiar with your body as you do this kind of practice. And one of the ways to do that familiarity is to do what's called the body scan. Some Buddhist traditions, it's the primary meditation practice they do, is just scanning through the body. We don't do it that often in our particular tradition, but sometimes it's taught and done. And today I'd like to suggest it as a way of exploring the familiarity with the body. It helps develop concentration, it helps wake up parts of the body that might be asleep, and explore what's in this body. What is this body of yours like? Some of us are completely disconnected with our body. Some of us are disconnected from certain parts of our body. There are people who are disconnected from the waist down. Some people are disconnected from the neck down. And different parts. Some people are disconnected with their back or with their belly or different parts of their body. And so this is one way of kind of intentionally going through the different parts of the body to connect and waken up those parts. It's a process of discovery, of seeing what's there. It's sometimes meant to be a training in equanimity, because there are parts of your body that might feel pleasant and parts of your body that might feel unpleasant. And the way the exercise works is you spend a few moments on one part of your body, and then you're instructed to move on to the next and the next. In the pleasant places, you might want to hang on. In the unpleasant places, you might want to, you know, react to. But if you know in a few moments you can move on, there tends to be sometimes some equanimity, some acceptance. Okay, I'll just be there for that now. I won't hang on to it. I won't reject it. I won't engage with it or try to make it better or worse. Or I'll just let it be as it is until, you know, explore it, get to know it. This is not an exercise in trying to elicit change in your body. It's an exercise in just getting to know well what's there, to awaken the sensitivities to what's there. So as a preliminary, I'd like to do an exercise, which I've done a lot lately, and that is close your eyes and hold your hand out. And bring your attention into your hand. And start feeling what's there, the sensations that are there. You might give particular focus to the palm of your hand. Is there vibration or tingling? Is there tension, weight, pressure? Is there temperature? Perhaps an interplay of the hand being warmer and the cool air across it. Sense your way into the fingers. If you really tune into what's happening in the fingers, what kind of sensations are really present there? Exploring it, feeling it. the back of the hand? Are there more or less sensations there compared to fingers or the palm? What is it? Sense and feel that. What happens to the sensations of your hand as you tune in to your hand? Does your hand become more sensitive, more alive, more vibrating, more? Is there a greater range of sensations than there would have been if you just kind of was aware of your hand kind of out of the corner of your eyes? Kind of. The sensations you feel in your hand now are always there. It isn't like you're making them particularly, but the hand becomes more alive, or we open to those sensations, and we tune into them in a way. It becomes a very, can be sometimes a very vitalized world of sensations in the hand, very full. And you can lower your hand. So as we go through the body scan, it's kind of the same thing where as you're directed to different parts of your body, sense your way into it, see if you can awaken the sensations there, discover what's there. If you come to places where there's no sensation, don't worry about it. It's enough just to hold your attention in that part of your body. If it's very faint, just hang out with the faintness. To have the kind of effort that it requires to hang in there with the faintness. If it's very strong, if it's painful, just have equanimity towards it. Allow it to be there until you move on. So with your eyes closed, sitting here upright, begin by bringing your attention to the top of your head, crown of your head. And spend a little while now sensing your way into the crown of your head. Perhaps at first there are no sensations. Perhaps as you hang in there, they get stronger. In a way of getting closer to a part of your body is not to hold your attention fixed in that part, or frozen at the part, but rather let your awareness kind of move a little bit, little shifts of attention moving around, little different angles, little different locations. Relax the tension that kind of moves and explores. And then as we move the attention through different parts of the body, you can either matter of fact kind of just move the attention there, or if you can do this, if it works for you, imagine that your attention is flowing like water, flowing down through the different parts of your body from one to the next. So starting from the crown of your head, let the attention flow or shift down into the area of your forehead. Feeling the sensations there. There of your temples. the sides of your skull. The eyes and the area around the eyes. And be content to feel whatever sensations happen to be there. There's no need to judge or comment on the sensations or worry that it's wrong or kind of sensations. Just very matter of fact how it is. The area of your cheekbones and nose. Your jaw, the jaw joint in the back, tracing the jaw to the front of the chin, jaw, the chin, the mouth area. And then moving to the neck, exploring the various parts of the neck, the top, the middle, the bottom, the sides, the back, the front, letting your attention move around, feeling it, sensing it. Different parts of your body will have different kinds of sensations. Can you notice the differences? If you feel vibration or humming or tingling, tune into that. And then down into the left shoulder. Feeling the top shoulder ridge from the neck down. The shoulder blade, the inside of the shoulder. And then moving slowly down the left arm, the upper arm. Feeling the three-dimensionality of the muscles, the flesh, the bone. The left elbow. in the left forearm, letting the attention flow and move down, feeling the sides, the back and the front of the forearm. The left wrist, and then down into the left hand, the palm, the back of the hand, the fingers. And then moving the attention up to the right shoulder. Becoming more sensitive to the range of sensations in the shoulder there. And then down the upper right arm. The right elbow. And then down the forearm. The wrist, and the hand and the fingers. And then move the attention to the upper chest, the area around your collarbones. down into your rib cage, front rib cage. Perhaps you feel movement there as you breathe, other sensations. The area of your breasts. In the back rib cage area. The upper spine. The area of your diaphragm. And the stomach area. Further down into the whole abdominal area. Sensing and feeling what's there. Getting to know it. It's almost as if it's speaking to you and you're just listening. What's there? The lower back, the lower spine. Area of your pelvic cavity, hips, the genital area. And then down into your left hip joint, left sitting bone. And then slowly move your attention down your left leg, upper left leg. The left knee, and then slowly down the lower left leg. The calves, shin, the left ankle, the heel. And then down into the foot. The toes. And then up to the right hip joint, sitting bone, right hip area. And then moving the attention down the upper right leg, the thigh, the right knee. the lower right leg. The ankle, the heel. The foot, and the toes. And then let your awareness flow in all directions to get a global sense of your body, the global vibration or presence or the sensations as they arise and pass throughout your body. If you find yourself thinking, feel the physicality of the thinking brain. Feel the felt sense of being involved with thinking, just like you did the other parts of the body. And if possible, relax. Relax into your body. We're going to sit here for 2 more minutes, and as thoroughly as you can, surrender to the sensations of the body. Give up everything else but just the flow of sensations. With some dedication, stay there with the sensations, moment by moment, discovering what happens there as you open to them. So we'll take a half an hour for a walking meditation. So the sitting will start again at 12:05, 5 minutes after 12. So taking a comfortable, alert posture. Gently closing your eyes. And taking two or three long, slow, deep breaths is a way of entering your body, connecting to your body, relaxing your body. Letting your breathing return to normal. And then aside from your breathing, sensations connected to your breathing, find the strongest sensation in your body. It doesn't have to be that strong, or it's what happens to be the strongest or most intense. And bring your attention to that part of your body. And those sensations, that sensation which is intense, that part of your body that's most strong. Kind of explore the spatial dimension of it. The size, kind of the shape, the area. Intensity of it, subtle, weak, strong, intense. If it disappears while you're attending to it, then find the next strongest sensation in your body. If it stays, then hang in there with it. To get to know it better, what characterizes the sensation? Is it hard or soft, or tight or loose, warm or cold, heavy or light? Is there pressure, or pulling or tightening? Or pain or pleasure? If it's possible, kind of surrender to the sensation, surrender to that part of the body. It's okay for it to be there. Notice any change that's connected to the sensation. Does it flicker or move around a little bit? Does it get stronger or weaker? If you get really close to the place where the sensation is most intense, does it stay fixed? Does it dance around, flicker around? So for this meditation period, let your body sensations take the lead, meaning that whatever is the strongest sensation at the moment, let that be the place where attention settles, where mindfulness is developed. Whereas in the last meditation, we systematically went through the body following the guidance. This time we're letting the body be the guide that tells you where you're supposed to feel and sense. And you can hang out for a long time in one place, as long as that's the strongest place in the body. If something place else becomes stronger, then shift. If it disappears or gets weak, then find the next strongest one. If you hang out with a strong sensation, it morphs into something else. Then track the morphing, track the changes. If you're hanging out with one sensation for a long time, remember the principle that it's easier to pay attention over time if your attention is quietly, relaxedly shifting and moving around that particular place than it is if you're fixed one pointedly. Getting to know it, exploring it, sensing it. Letting the mind become quiet and still. If you have reactions or judgments about what you're experiencing, either let go of them or let them be in the background. The foreground of attention is this great, the sensations of the body, letting the awareness move around the body as the body produces its own sensations. Letting the arising of body sensations be the guide for your attention. Whatever happens to be the most strongest sensation or the most compelling, most interesting sensation, let the attention flow there, rest there. Sometimes the attention will flow freely around the body from place to place. And sometimes it'll stay in one place for a long time. Let the body be the guide. coming back to your body, letting your body tell you where your attention should be. This involves a giving up of control, giving up of the control of where your attention should be, letting the body just randomly, freely manifest itself. Whatever wants to come to the surface. So in a few minutes, we'll stop for lunch and take an hour for lunch. And I'd encourage you to take the lunchtime in silence because that's often the way that the momentum or the continuity from the morning to the afternoon works best. Stay in a kind of contemplative mode, quiet, calm with yourself. Before we do a break for lunch, I would like to hear from some of you, if you will, what the morning was like so far, what the last sitting was like. Was it, what happened to you when you tried to just let the body take the lead and bring your attention to follow around the body? What was it like to do the body scan?
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about them or just thinking about other things? Thinking about them or thinking about other things?
You mean thinking about the sensations?
Or yeah.
No, other things uh-huh. that arise. That the only thing that seems to help is to notice this, the physical sensations around the thinking.
Great. Uh-huh. Great. Perfect. Perfect. Yes?
I found that pleasant sensations were nice, but unpleasant sensations are really focusing much more. So after I come away from the unpleasant sensation, I find my mind more focused before the unpleasant sensation. Mm-hmm. The pleasurable ones do seem to focus as well.
Uh-huh. They weren't as compelling. Uh-huh.
For me, I was focusing on this strong pain in my knee, and I felt that as I was focusing more on it, it got stronger, and I had to move, and I did, and it got better after that. So, in a way, I felt bad that I had to move and I couldn't stay in my position, but then it went better after that, so.
Good. Careful you don't get addicted to it,
yeah.
Being it that way. How many of you found it was difficult, this last meditation, the instructions? Some of you found it difficult? Some of you find it interesting, helpful? Some people are very much into controlling their experience. The idea of giving up control, to just letting the body kind of speak and you just follow. Was that challenging a little bit? Or?
I was feeling some fear around doing that. I was having quite a lot of knee pain. And when you mentioned just letting the body control where the tension was, I experienced some fear around that. The pain was going to become too strong for me.
Mm-hmm.
Concentrating on, say, my right shoulder, and suddenly the area in my left shoulder blade might pop up too and want equal attention. Let's say, what's the relationship? But it seemed like both were equally strong, so I would hold both of them, and they would both pulsate and behave really similar, as if they were part of one thing. That happened in really different parts of the body. And behave very similar, pulsate at the same frequency, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the core was hard, and the
great, thank you.
Yeah. I had another experience of catching myself drifting, thinking about something, and all of a sudden, in just this small period of time, I felt like I was watching myself. I was a vessel. And I was within inside myself, but outside of myself, and just this beam of light. And it was just, you know.
Very nice. Okay, well, thank you for those reports. I appreciate it. And so let's take an hour. And start again at 1:45, and so you're welcome to set yourself up in chairs and stuff in the social hall there. Just take chairs out of here if you need to, and sit around, or take some chairs and put them on the porch there if you want to sit outside on the porch, or in the parking lot. You know, just be sure you bring the chairs back in again. So in that, the theme for today is mindfulness of the body. A very important part of mindfulness of the body is mindfulness of your posture. And some meditators kind of just take their posture for granted or try to keep pragmatic posture that kind of works for them and keeps them without too much discomfort. They don't give it much thought beyond that. But posture is a very important part of our lives. The posture we take, both in sitting meditation, but just in generally in our lives. And in paying attention to the body, you can pay attention from the inside out, from sensations and everything. You can also pay attention kind of the structural way the body is, the posture that the body takes. And there's a lot you can learn from your posture, a lot you can learn from what your body, how you hold your body in different circumstances. We express a lot through our body. A lot of communication happens the way we tip our head, the way we use our eyebrows or our face, or the way we kind of, how close we stand to someone, how far away, or what angle we face someone, or how much we kind of slump perhaps, or how much we sit up straight. A lot is actually communicated, and sometimes the posture that we take is a form of communication. We are talking to people around. We want to communicate something to others. And often that level of communication for many of us is a little bit unconscious or subconscious. It's at a level we don't necessarily, it's not often connected to that level of the of our intentionality, which we're not paying careful attention to. The posture also expresses how we're feeling. If you're feeling blue, you know, you're more likely to slump. If you're feeling kind of really elated, you're more likely to be kind of straight, upright. How we react and relate to the world around us is manifested in the posture that we take. Also, the posture, in the same kind of the same reason, is kind of an antenna of how what's happening in the world around us. I think of the posture as kind of like an antenna that's ready to pick up all kinds of stuff. Our body's an antenna that's expressed in the posture. Paying attention to the posture then can give you access to this part of the mind, your intentionality, your communication, your emotions, your reactions, that can be very helpful. When is it that you're kind of pulling away from someone? When is it you're turning away from something? I remember when I was first getting really into paying attention to my posture, I was at Tassajara, and I noticed, I was in the kitchen at the monastery, and I noticed that how I worked, my relationship to my work, was exhibited in my posture that I took. So if I was, you know, the Zen thing was kind of really be there for the cutting of the carrots, you know, chopping carrots, you would try to be there full-fledged, you know, completely there, one with your carrots, right? And so I would try to face the carrots and be there kind of, you know, my whole body, my feet planted, my body facing the cutting board, just really be there for that, my whole body being there for that event. And that was fine when I can do it. And every once in a while I notice that my body would be turned almost to a 90 degree to the cutting board, and one foot was kind of heading towards the door. And those are the moments I didn't really want to be there. I was kind of impatient for it to be over and kind of carrots. And what does that have to do with spiritual practice, you know? You know, how dull. You know, I want the real stuff where enlightenment is. You know, it couldn't possibly be over a cutting board. And so, you know, my posture, you know, my disinterest in that, my desire to get away or escape or all kinds of things, but then expressed in that turning away of the posture to get away. And so I noticed that. It was very instructive for me to notice how my posture changed with my relationship to not just that cutting board. A relationship we have with certain people, the posture changes. We protect ourselves. We try to get involved, engage ourselves based on our posture. Remember many years ago when I was a college student, I came home really depressed one day, and I became the Guinness Book of Records candidate for the most slumped couch potato. I was just, you know, my shoulders were down the crack of the couch, you know, just kind of feeling so sorry for myself. And the posture was so dramatic that I was slumping so much that it caught my attention. So I thought, well, what would happen if I sat up straight? And I sat up straight, and most of my depression vanished. I know it's usually not that easy, but shifting the posture can make a very big difference in our relationship to ourselves and what's being expressed and what's going on. And it's a two-way street in the sense that, for example, our attitudes, our emotions affect our posture, and then our posture affects our emotions and our attitudes. And if you sometimes adjusting your posture can adjust your attitude to some degree, sometimes more successfully than others. One of the postural things that we did at the Zen monastery was we often bowed, a lot of bowing, so much bowing that the saying is, if in doubt, bow. And I counted once how many times we bowed before 9 o'clock in the morning, and just kind of ceremonially bowed, it's like 54 times. And so I just did it because it was part of the routine that you're supposed to do it. But after doing it for quite a long time, I noticed that I think it was a very slow conditioning. It's very slowly affected me in a healthy, I thought a positive way, in that putting your hands down together in front of your heart is a form of expression of appreciation, of gratitude, of something. And putting my hands together like that, even though I was kind of just doing this rote at first, elicited first maybe just little hints of those feelings. And because I did it so often, those feelings would tend to become more to the foreground because of the kind of what I was doing with my posture. The repeated habits of posture affect, you know, helps create character, in a sense, who we are. So there's both the possibility of paying attention to our posture, learning from it, learning all kinds of things from our posture. And there's also a possibility of adjusting our posture in a way that's more helpful for us, more supportive of being awake or being attentive or energized or, you know, whatever is the appropriate thing you're trying to develop. And I want to tell you the story of when I was practicing in Thailand and in Nepal. I've told the story many times. I was one of my first Vipassana retreats with Upandita. And there were a few of us Westerners practicing there in Nepal, very close quarters. And I was given a little room to live in. The room was smaller than the stage, maybe just between the posts and the stage, and about that wide. And there were maybe even narrower, shorter, anyway, really small. It was four of us, four men in the room, and we kind of were laying next to each other. We slept next to each other. There was about enough space for the four of us to lay next to each other. And then we would also have to meditate. We all sat and meditated there. We'd go outside for walking meditation or to eat. And one of the people in the room with me was one of the more renowned American Vipassana teachers, who, that was the first time I met him. We were sitting this retreat together. And the way the interviews worked, we all went in together as a group to Upandita for interviews. And then I think he kind of had the system where the most senior Vipassana, the most senior student there would give the first interview report, and so all the others could hear. And then they would, that person would leave, and the next person. So if you were last, and I was last always, I got to hear everybody else's interviews. So it's kind of interesting. So I got to hear this my roommate's interview. And he, at some point halfway through the retreat, started talking about his back pain. And he would describe it, because he was very good at his mindfulness. He would really be there present for it. And I had no indication from how he was sitting that he was in excruciating pain. But these reports of his pain was, you know, it was obvious that he, at some point he said that if he was back in America, he'd go to a chiropractor. But being in Kathmandu, it wasn't so easy. And he had this exquisite, you know, description of the details of physical back pain. You know, it's like he was right there for every little nuance and, you know, of what it was like. Very concentrated, very present. But it was obvious that every day was like, you know, he could describe it very well, but it was getting, you know, more and more intense, more and more intense. So, since we sat together in the same room, I noticed that when he meditated like this. And I had come from the Zen tradition, and Zen puts a lot of emphasis on the importance of meditation posture. And so I was sitting, you know, basically, you know, my Zen posture, you know, very upright and straight. And so it must have been quite a contrast, at least when I was awake. So I had some concern, you know, for him. So at some point I broke one of the cardinal rules of retreat. I went over and talked to him. Just, you know, may I give you, you know, may I say something here? Can I give you some advice? And he was a very kind guy, he said, sure. And he said, you know, if you just sat up a little bit straighter, it might be you wouldn't have so much back problem. And he looked at me very kindly and he said, oh, in Zen, you do it from the outside in. In Vipassana, we do it from the inside out. Meaning that the posture comes, you know, from paying attention to the inside and what feels like inside, you kind of, that's how the process goes. In Zen, you have a form that you fit yourself into, a form, an idea, you know, posture from the outside in. And I just kind of, inside my head, from the inside out, shook my head. And well, I guess there's no talking to this guy. Because, you know, maybe there's a balance between those two worlds. It doesn't have to be all inside out or all outside in, but you can just use your common sense and sometimes, you know, do it from the outside in. So posture is very important, and meditation posture is important. It's important for a few different reasons, as I already said. But one of them is that if you can take an aligned posture, in the long term, you're more comfortable in your posture when you meditate. And it's unfortunate to have discomfort as you when you sit that could have been easily alleviated with sitting straighter. Also, if you can sit in an aligned posture, balanced posture, it allows for the greatest possibility of the musculature to relax. If you're slumped forward like this, the shoulders can't go very far if you're tense. But if you're sitting up straight, then they can actually go much further. They can relax further. There's more room for them to move in. And I believe in many ways that there's a greater possibility of relaxation if the body is kept upright in an alert way, balanced in an aligned way. And so I think that's really healthy in return, because sometimes the mind leads the body, sometimes the body leads the mind. The more you can relax, also the more aligned you are then, and upright and balanced, the more your tension gets revealed. So say you have a chronically tight belly, and you're slumped over like this, you might not feel the tension in there very easily. But if you sit upright, it might be revealed and shown itself because you're kind of exposing it more, or the tension here or someplace. So taking an aligned posture allows for the greatest revelation of what's going on in your body so that it can be processed or worked through and hopefully help you in your practice. Sometimes the process of coming to an aligned upright posture is more uncomfortable before it's comfortable. There's holding patterns in our body. You know, some muscles are really tight and some muscles are really weak. And then to come to a place where we can more or less be balanced, we have to work against those muscles. And sometimes they ache for a while until they release or until they get strong enough. And that's just the way it is. And it's well worth the effort to work through that kind of conditioning of the body so that the posture supports you in practice rather than the body and the posture just being an appendage to the practice. It's possible to practice with the body kind of like an appendage. I mean, people get enlightened in Burma, slumping in their meditation practice. You don't have to sit straight and upright and well in order to get enlightened. But I think it really helps a lot, especially for those of us, you know, who are just trying to practice in daily life, in ordinary life, and trying to make the application of practice in everyday life. Being able to have a good sense of posture is really helpful. So I think, you know, the great majority of you all have quite good posture as you sit here. And some of you know a lot of these things already, either you've been told these things before, or you figured them out on your own. But what I'd like to do for this next sitting is to go around the room and adjust all your postures, or most of your postures. And adjustment doesn't mean it's a correction. It doesn't mean that you're doing something wrong. It just means it's an adjustment to give you a sense of a different way of holding your body as you meditate. And then for you to kind of gauge or get a sense of what that's like. And see if it might be more useful, giving you more energy, more alertness, more balance, more freedom, more something. And maybe it's something you want to adopt as a change that helps you. And maybe it's something that you was interesting once and you go back to how you were. I'll kind of come up from behind you, except for the people sitting against the wall. And I will make a gentle, little adjustment to your back. Mostly just the back. Sometimes your arms and hands and your head. And I might say something, just suggest something as I go around. And if you'd rather not be adjusted, when I come and touch you gently in the shoulders, you can shake your head. And I'll understand that means no. And I'll go on somewhere else. Yes? With your hands together?
Yes. Here, and I was like, my legs, I just didn't feel like it, except like this. And I also experienced feeling like a moment of fear, like, I don't know, my body wants to start doing all these other things. Because you're like, not like here, it's kind of fine. So,
it happens sometimes. More often it happens on retreat than in a longer retreat than something like this. But it happens that sometimes the body, the energy or the movement, the muscles in the body, seemingly spontaneously want to take on different postures, sometimes quite unusual. Sometimes spontaneous yoga postures. Some people have suggested that yoga postures were invented by people who meditated and these things were moving through them in different ways. And it can be very, very powerful, the impulse inside of us to kind of take a different shape, posture with our whole body. If you have any, there's various strategies of what to do about this when it occurs. Sometimes a person has no choice, it's just so powerful, the impulse, that it's fine. It's just this stuff is known to happen. Sometimes it can be more useful to feel the impulse to move and not move and hold yourself still, but open yourself to the sensation, to the impulse, the urge, and see if you can let the impulses or the urge and energy move through you freely, channel through you freely, without having to take a particular posture to give it expression. And that sometimes is really a very useful thing to do. Sometimes it's useful to see what the emotion is that might be connected to it, because sometimes it's an expression of a powerful emotion that we're trying to somehow compensate for or protect or express or something. And if you can figure out what the emotion is, if that's the case, then maybe you can find another way of processing and besides doing something with your posture and your body. So those are some things. Okay, so take a comfortable, alert posture. Taking some care as we start this sitting to both from the inside and outside, being attentive to your posture. Establishing an upright posture. From the inside, you can feel, perhaps, what posture does your body want to take? If your body wants to be alert, what posture would it take? Your spine, how would it like to be? And feel your sitting bones against the chair or the cushion. And feel the balance of the weight on the two sitting bones. Is it more on one side or the other? Or is your weight projected forward or backwards? Sway back and forth or forward and backward. See if you can find a midpoint where your center of gravity is, where your weight is distributed right down the middle on both sitting bones. And then slowly travel up your spine. Feel the weight of your body, your torso. And see if, again, if you're projected forward with your weight, center of gravity, or backwards. And see if you can line up your vertebrae so the weight of your torso goes right down the middle. Going up your spine to the last vertebrae before the skull, that area there where the neck meets the back of the skull. Is it compressed there? Tight? Sometimes if you can open that area up, lift the back of your skull up, it makes a little bit of space there to make it feel more open. It can be helpful to have your belly be really relaxed. If you have a tight belt, to loosen it so the belly can hang forward. Then as you feel the posture and your body in this posture, where do you have the most sensations of your body? Some people feel more on one side of their body than the other. Some people might feel more in the front of their body, less in the back. Some people above the waist, some people below the waist. As you're sitting here for this sitting, you might be with your breathing, attentive to your breath, each breath. A particular feeling what happens in your torso as you breathe. The undulations of sensations of movement in your body as you breathe. And see how that undulation, that expansion and contraction, the waves, movement of the belly, of the rib cage, of the spine, how it might support your posture, help you be upright. I was wondering if there were what that was like for some of you, and if you had any questions based on that or concerns. Great.
I did something with my head that I can't remember. relationship to the shoulders?
I think so. I think it'd be good for you to be more out there. And it wasn't that dramatic. And as for the neck, I don't know. It could be that it's just the adjustment process. It could have revealed tension that was always there, but now it gets pointed out in a sense. We'll see. I don't know. We'll see. Sometimes when people get adjusted, the adjustment from the outside is actually quite small, and from the inside it feels like it's, you know, it's like, you got to be kidding. I mean, I used to lean a lot to one side, and then the teachers would straighten me out. And I was convinced that now I was leaning the other direction. Yes?
I had no idea I was leaning so far over to one side until you kind of tilted me back. But it was helpful for my shoulder back, for my breathing.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't falling asleep afterwards.
Good.
Yeah, I was reminded of Ed Sullivan and the man who spun the 20 plates. You know, he would spin one plate and go down the line, and then just as he spun the last one, he'd have to run back. And it just felt that, you know, you could start over. And because if you do feel like you're straight and you're like this, and you put us like this, and we feel like this, then we're going to go back. But over time.
Over time, yeah. It's true that maybe it's possible that I should go around and adjust posture more often than, you know, once every 2 years or so would I have these kind of classes. Yeah, it might be something you develop that capacity in small dosages. You know, you at home maybe 10 minutes at a time at first, kind of to build up some strength there, and then slowly also loosen the tension that's also inherent there also. And there's also exercises a person can do. Sometimes there's a great exercises for the upper mid back, you know, to kind of open it up there and relax it and I think yoga is good. Next Saturday, Lali Font's going to come and do yoga for meditation posture. And I'm really happy she's doing it because it's posture, for me, is a really important element of practice. And to have Lali coming in to talk about the posture from her point of view and then giving all kinds of exercises, yoga exercises, support it, I think I'm hoping a lot of people will go and benefit from it. So, you'll learn a little bit from the inside. So the idea with being adjusted is not that you're supposed to hold this posture now forever, though you can try to kind of come back to that, but it's more like it's re-educating your body. Oh, there's another possibility, there's another way, and now you'll never quite go back to the old way, hopefully. You'll have some little bit of, you know, physical memory of another way, and your body kind of can move towards that direction. Yeah.
What I noticed was primarily that my breath suddenly was able to drop more easily into my lower stomach. I felt as if I was remembering the ease with which that happened. Mm-hmm. I could move my posture and try to recreate that.
Uh-huh. Great. And it, you know, it. I wondered, looking at your posture, I wondered whether the way in which you held your upper back had some effect on the pain in your lower back, and by straightening out the upper back, whether it would actually improve things down below, put less pressure on it.
was aware of energy. It just shot up to my head.
Yeah.
And my head was so much clearer. It was very nice.
Good.
Yeah. It just broke through the thinking.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Once I got adjusted, the only thing I could concentrate on was the posture, so I guess I'm in for several months of mindfulness of the posture. Nothing else came. I couldn't go anywhere else in my body. I was concentrating on the posture.
In Zen practice, the two main foci for Zazen posture is the breath and the posture. And the Zen students are constantly going back between the two of those and paying attention to the posture. There's all these little details of posture. So it's a wonderful exercise. It's a wonderful way of keeping mindfulness. And in my own practice, it's kind of like always there in the background, some attention to my posture because of my Zen training in part. And it helps. It's one of the things that helps me get concentrated is because my mind is engaged in that presence there. Yeah. You were using the backrest already when I came to you, and the way you were using it smaller your back was it let you slump a little bit, kind of resting back into the chair, and by taking like rolling up a towel or something and just supporting the middle of the mid spine, that can kind of pulls the torso back a little bit, lets it kind of settle back. It keeps you more upright, pushing you out a little bit in a sense, I guess, rather than tending to slump back. And that's when I looked at you, that's what I thought. Yes, Mita.
You didn't interest me at all, so does that mean I have perfect posture? You're too scared to touch me.
I wasn't scared. And but the way you're sitting, because I know you have physical issues, and I didn't feel like I wanted to get involved with your posture without knowing much more your physical thing, because you've meditated enough that I just thought I didn't want to mess in there.
Did you notice anything particular?
No, I mean, it's fine. Well, I mean, you were using the backrest, and usually most of the people I corrected by getting them to sit up more straight. But with you, I just didn't feel... It seemed like you were relaxed sitting there.
And that's not how we felt inside at all.
And it's something maybe, you know, one-on-one, you know, after a class or something, we could do it to talk about it, where we can actually talk and work on something together. But going around like that, it just didn't seem like it was the time. Some of you had, a few people I didn't adjust at all, partly because you sat really well. And I mean, from a Zen point of view, very balanced. It seemed they didn't see anything that needed to be adjusted. And some of you, like, you're sitting against the back wall. Just being against the back wall was kind of hard to get behind you, and you seemed pretty, you know, just seemed like it was, you know, I didn't know what to do. So, hopefully that was useful for you, enough of you. And it's something, if you go on retreats or if you, you know, hang around for a while, you might ask the teacher or ask me, you know, once in a while, to come and check your meditation posture as you're sitting. Because it's very helpful to get some or a friend to do it. It's very helpful, or a yoga teacher or something, to get some external reference for how your posture is and get little help that way. Because from the inside, you know, it's kind of hard to track what's going on. Always. So that's the issue of posture. I hope I conveyed to you my sense of its importance. A lot of Vipassana students, I feel, don't give it much importance. And I actually feel when I sit here as a teacher in our group, I feel kind of proud, you know, because I feel like people sit generally quite well. And the reputation is that Vipassana students, you know, slump a lot. But I think that our group sits quite well. And But even so, when my Zen friends come here, some of them, and they look at us, they say, yeah, they could use a little bit of tweaking. So before my next Zen friend comes to give a talk, I'll be sure to prep you guys and tune you up. Bring back the stick. Anyway, I hope it was helpful. And it's something you can carry with you now and work with a little bit for your benefit. So let's take... half an hour for some walking practice. And let's start again at 3:20 it would be, in here. Taking a comfortable, alert posture. Taking some care in your posture as you sit down. Gently closing your eyes. And then feel your breathing. Feel the body's experience of breathing. If you'd like, you can take some breaths which are a little bit fuller than usual, just to help you for a minute or two to establish a connection with your breathing. Feeling the physical experience of breathing, physical effect of the breathing on your body. There's the body, the bodily experience of breathing, the physical experience. There's the awareness that we apply or bring to our bodily experience. And then there's the mental qualities that go along with the mindfulness practice. Just like a massage therapist has the body that they massage, they have the hands which they connect with, and they put a lot of awareness in their hands to really stay present. And there's all kinds of mental qualities that they develop to be a really good masseuse. One of the qualities is developing concentration. Intentness, being intent on what you're doing. So one of the qualities to develop in sitting is a certain kind of intentness that's not stressful or tight, but being intent on being mindful, being present. Like there's a little bit of fire within you. Fire, passion, zeal, intentness, firmness. I don't know what the right word is for any one of you. And as you stay intent on your breathing, sooner or later, something will make it difficult for you to be with your breathing. Something will pull you away. And for the duration of this sitting, if something pulls you away from the breath, If it's easy to go back to the breath, continue with your intent, fire of attention on the breath, then do so. If it's difficult to be with the breathing, if the other thing really needs attention, then keep it very simple and connect to the physical part of that experience, the felt sense of what that's like. If you're involved in a lot of thoughts, what's the physical felt sense within your body of thinking? So if it's an emotion that arises, what's the felt sense of the emotion? Grounding that experience in the body. So during the whole sitting, you stay in your body. Anything that takes you away from the breath, you turn it around, or you yield yourself to the physical side of that experience. Sounds are really loud outside of the traffic. What's the felt sense of that? The physical experience of that. Sitting here with some fire, some attentiveness, presence. The same kind of dedication to presence as maybe you would have expect from a really good massage therapist or really good, or an artist who's really engaged in her work. Or so it's about 5 minutes to four. We go until 4:30 today. And I thought of spending a little bit of time talking about pain. Or alternatively, we can just sit here some more and how many of you sat with some pain today? What would you like to know about pain? Before I talk about pain, though, I want to ask you, so there's kind of a theme that's come up a few times today, is this idea of using the analogy of something else, like massage or art, or there can be other analogies that are just as good. There's different things going on there. There's the thing that's being attended to, the canvas or the clay for the artist or the body for the masseuse. And then there's the contact that's made with the masseuses, the hands that are connecting. And then there's all the qualities of mind, of heart and things that the artist or the masseuse brings to bear on the practice. And that analogy then translates to our practice, you know, with there's the body we pay attention to. There's the attention which we massage our body with, or we explore our body with. And then there's all these mental qualities that come into play also. And that those mental qualities we don't have to take for granted. We're just content to have whatever is there. But just like you would expect that someone who gets developed as a massage therapist develops certain inner qualities in the course of their training. Attention, attentiveness, concentration, care, a sense of exploration, and discovering what's there, familiarity. So in the same way, when we practice meditation, you can expect that certain inner qualities are being developed, and they should be developed in the course of the practice. And there's a whole slew of them that's part of that. And the last sitting I recommended, that suggested one of the things we're developing is a certain intentness, engagement, firmness, fire. I don't know what the right word is for any one of you, but I suggested you sit there with some intentness, if you remember. Could you do that? Was that useful to try to bring that to the practice? What happened? Are there inner qualities that you appreciated that you're trying to develop together with just being mindful? You're all just stunned. Fran?
Well, like, for me, it's commitment is a huge thing, because I don't want to get used to it on that. There's a commitment that I make that is something I do, and I just take myself to it.
Great, and so that...
It's huge for me.
So every time you follow through on that commitment, you're strengthening that capacity to being committed. Great. Very nice. Yeah?
I sit with pain a lot, and the quality that is the most helpful is kindness. And I have to keep remembering that.
Mm-hmm. Good. So you're developing kindness. Yeah. So the qualities of mind that are developed in practice come into play a lot when you're working with pain. So I want to talk a little bit about pain. Some of you maybe could talk about it, are experts on it, and talk a lot about it. But a few things. One is pain is a normal part of life, even though many of us are not ready to accept that as a fact. It's just really common. There's all kinds of pain we can expect. There's injuries, and there's pain from disease. There's pain from emotional pain, psychological pain. There's pain of growing old and body not working so much and starting to be filled with pains and aches. There's undefined headaches, and all kinds of ways in which pain comes through in part of our life. If you sit still long enough in one posture, as some of you might have noticed today, the body gets uncomfortable, and it gets, you feel the pain of that. There's many different kinds of pain. And at the same time, as there's lots of pain in human life, there's a tremendous tendency among humans to run away from pain or try to get rid of it or stop it. And to a great extent, it's completely healthy to try to not have pain. There's nothing wrong with that motivation. And if there's some kind of, if you have an injury or disease or something is off in the environment that needs to be fixed, then by all means it should be fixed. You know, take your medicine, do whatever you can to fix it. What we find in American society is that pain, means of pain relief is a multi-billion dollar business. And every indication that, you know, people are experts at finding something out there to fix the pain, to make the pain go away. And if we're too quick at doing it at every possible occasion of pain, then we're not learning some other way of relating to the pain. And learning some other way of relating to the pain is certainly part of the function of this practice. So then the question is, you know, what is the appropriate ways of relating to pain? What's the meaning of pain? What is pain? And I can think of two very general ways in which pain, maybe several ways in which pain is useful. The most important one is that pain is a message. The message is something's wrong, that something is off, something is needs attention. So if you have pain, something needs attention, something needs attending to. And if you're too quick to find a way to avoid the pain, like if you take something to numb the pain, or then you might not understand, then you might not be paying attention to what really needs attention in that situation. Say you get a headache, and it's fine and normal to, you know, to take an aspirin for the headache, but something wants attention when you have a headache. And if by taking an aspirin, you're avoiding bringing attention to the whole phenomena of the headache, and you might not then learn that in fact you have a headache because of you're constantly worrying or some stress you're carrying around with you through the day. And if you're always relying on the aspirin rather than relying on your powers of observation and studying the situation, then you'll never learn and you'll be endlessly providing profits for the aspirin industry. Which is, you know, a fine thing to do. I mean, bet they're good people, but there's all this you can learn in studying, investigating something as simple as a headache. Sometimes maybe there's nothing to learn there. Who knows why the headache is there? And maybe aspirin is the right thing to do. Sometimes if you don't take care of it with an aspirin, maybe it spirals out of control and becomes, you know, unworkable. But one of the functions of pain is it's a message that says, pay attention here. Something needs attention. Something needs fixing and changing. And if we're too quick to get rid of the pain, then maybe we don't understand some of the deeper structures of the pain, the deeper causes and conditions for it, that maybe would really serve us well to understand. Another function of physical pain has to do with the whole realm of practice, spiritual life. In Buddhism, we talk a lot about purification. Some teachers focus on the role of pain in our life. One of the meanings or possibilities of pain is that it's purifying, or that it develops inner qualities, or it helps release inner baggage, extra stuff that we're carrying in our mind, holding patterns, resistance, fears that are unnecessary. Some people talk about physical pain as being this fire that burns up our defilements. It burns up all this extra stuff that doesn't not need it to be there. And so pain has a function of purifying, if you allow it to. And that's a really big thing, if you allow it to. Because one option to have about physical pain when it arises is self-pity, is hate, is aversion, is hopelessness. There's a lot of ways in which we relate to the pain, which certainly depress us at times, and sometimes actually augment the pain, strengthen the pain. And part of what we're asked to do in Buddhist practice, is to recontextualize pain, or to understand it in a new way. I have a different conceptual framework of what the meaning or the purpose or the function or the possibilities that's inherent in pain. If you think that there's no purpose in pain, then there is no purpose in pain. Then it's just a drag. But if you can see there's a purpose in pain, then when pain arises, you have a different relationship to it, than the normal ones of self-pity and aversion, whatever it might be there. Now, is it reasonable to say that the pain has a purpose? Some of you have had a lot of pain in your life, and it can sound a bit callous of me to say that. It's kind of like, you know, he doesn't understand, you know, what kind of pain I've been through. And, you know, to say that it has a purpose, you know, I've been, you know, struggling. It's been such a heavy struggle for me. But I think that that any pain at all, I believe that any pain at all that arises can have the function of purification, can have the function of helping us unload some of the baggage and extra stuff that we carry with us. And try to explain a little bit why I think that. First, an example from my own practice. There are times in my meditation practice where I've had a lot of physical pain. Generally in my situation, that pain has been something that I've chosen in the sense that I could always gotten up and left. You know, it wasn't a pain that was kind of sometimes I've had back pain that's kind of stayed with me quite intensely or other pains. But generally the most intense pains I've had in meditation, I had some choice about it. I could have gotten up and done something different. And I wouldn't have felt the pain. But I chose to hang in there with it, to stay there with it. And there are times when, you know, it was really, you know, I can give you horror stories of what it was like. Some of you have heard some of the stories. I would get up from meditation and my whole body would be shaking for 10 minutes because I've been sitting with so much pain. I could sit still during the meditation, but I'd get up and be shaking, you know, shivering from the pain. After 10 minutes, it was Zen practice, so you only had 10 minutes between sittings. And so then I managed to get myself together after 10 minutes of shaking, and then I go back to sit again. And I thought in Zen practice you weren't supposed to move. And you're kind of not supposed to, that's the rhetoric. But I didn't know that people around me were moving. And I just, you know, was kind of young and naive and stupid, and I said, oh, you sit there. And what I found was that I was sitting there in this tremendous fire of pain, and that all these extra things that I carried with me couldn't survive that fire. And some of the extra things, for example, that carried with me was my spiritual idealism. You know, what I thought spiritual practice was all about, what I was trying to accomplish and attain, my goals. And none of it mattered in the pain. It's like it's vanished, you know. My 22-year-old idealism about what spiritual life was supposed to get me just evaporated in that pain. Just the pain was so intense. And in so much, you know, self-image burned up, for at least for that moment, to the pain. It just wasn't important how other people saw me, particularly. So much got burned up, at the moment at least. And I got to see myself and see life very raw, very naked, without a lot of the extra concepts, ideas, values that often would get in the way of my life as I lived it. And then the question was, you know, what is important? The question for me was, what was really important about life? What was important about being aware, being present, in the context of all these things burning up and just sitting there with the pain? And that was kind of like my koan, my question. I would be there engaged. I had to be engaged. There was no choice, I felt, I mean, because I wasn't going to move. You know, to really face this question, you know, what was my life like? What was the value of being alive? What was when everything else was taken away, was stripped away through the pain? And that's a kind of purification process. It's a kind of emptying process. And so much that I consider extra vanished in that. And I found that was really valuable. Some people in some traditions around the world, people do ascetic practices partly for that reason. They inflict pain on themselves to kind of naturally to do that kind of burning up of stuff. The American sweat lodge tradition, depending on the person who has the control of the fire, I mean, that's kind of, they crank it up really hot in there. It's quite intense. You think you're going to die. And it's kind of like just burning up all this stuff. One of the things that gets revealed in the process of hanging in there with pain is how we relate to pain, how we relate to discomfort, how we relate to things not going the way we want it to go. And part of the function of being with pain, one of the values of pain, if you choose to see this value in it, is it really helps you understand how you relate to adversity in your life. there's often patterns in how different people relate. Some people are hate types, and they just kind of lash out at discomfort or pain. And one friend of mine I've talked about often, he had pain in his knees when he meditated, so he pushed back at his knees to hurt it back. That seems pretty stupid to me. But, you know, that's, he was kind of an aversive type, and he would, you know, hurt his knees further until he had knee surgery. Some people try to run away from adversity and from pain and difficulties, and so just anything to get me out of here. Some people go into fantasy life, and they live, spin a whole fantasy. You know, there's all kinds of patterns that people have about how they relate to pain. Some people deny it. Some people choose to numb out. We learn a lot about ourselves in the context of facing our pain. And if we learn about ourselves in the context of pain, then we learn, it often applies to all kinds of other situations in life when we come into difficulty. Because the same pattern of relating exists there. So we learn a lot about ourselves by being there with the pain. So it has meaning, has purpose to be with the pain because we're learning about ourselves. So I'm suggesting there's now so far two purposes. Kind of emptying or burning, a purifying purpose, and this learning about ourselves purpose. There's also the purpose of developing certain qualities of mind. Developing patience, developing equanimity, developing surrender sometimes. I give up. You know, just take me over, pain. I give up. I can't resist you anymore. So just, this is it. There's developing kindness, compassion. I had a lot of physical pain in my practice and emotional pain in my early years. And after kind of many years of practice, I looked back to those early years and my struggles and my pain to discover that one of the things that was happening was that I was developing compassion. I wasn't aware of it at the time. I wasn't wanting it. I didn't think compassion was important. And I wasn't trying to. But the fact that I was in there, hanging in there and suffering and feeling the pain and then feeling empathy with other people feeling so much pain, my capacity for compassion grew a lot because of my being there for that pain. So compassion is an inner quality that can grow with being with pain. And it's pretty common that I've had the experience of teaching a retreat and someone comes to me in interviews complaining about their pain, how difficult it is, and sometimes there's an element of self-pity with it or struggle with it, or despair with it, discouragement. Oh, you know, this retreat was no good. You know, what's the purpose of this retreat? I struggled for 10 days. All I had was pain. I don't think I got anything out of it. It hasn't been that dramatic. I'm kind of building it up. But, you know, sometimes people have that kind of attitude. And they come back to me 6 months later and say, you know, because I went through that difficulty, whatever it was in that retreat, I had so much more acceptance and compassion and kindness for my friend who was going through similar difficulties in their life. And I didn't realize at the time that that was going to be the result of that retreat. But I'm so glad that I had that ability to help my friend. If I hadn't gone through a retreat, I wouldn't have the compassion for it. So there's all these inner qualities that can be developed as we hang out with pain. So there can be meaning or purpose in being mindful and being present for pain. So when is it that we try to change our pain and fix it? And when do we practice mindfulness just hanging out with it? Hopefully your common sense comes into play. And there are times when it just makes a lot of sense to fix what's going on, fix the environment, fix the situation. If there's a splinter in your toe and it hurts to walk, by all means, take the splinter out. Don't practice mindfulness of pain. I think that's dumb. So if you can do something, you know, it's obvious and fix it. If you're meditating on retreat and sitting here, in that situation, there might be times when you decide not to change, not to fix the pain to make it go away by laying down or by changing your posture or getting up or taking an aspirin, because you know that maybe it's valuable in this particular context to work with the pain, to practice with it. This is a kind of a very, very valuable laboratory that's very seldom people have in their lives. In this laboratory, within reason, I'm going to try to work with this pain, develop, you know, have the purifying effect of it, have the cultivation of inner qualities, having learn about myself. This is really good place to do that. If I can do this under these optimal conditions here, maybe I can learn something really a lot. Maybe I can get a lot of these benefits and I can carry them back into my normal life. So a lot of people will decide when they sit and meditate and they have the knee pain, the back pain, not because they've been told you shouldn't move and they don't want to look bad. Looking good was really important for our Zen students. I would sit there trying to look really good, not move, and then I would... Is anybody noticing me? I don't know. Or, the late night sitting, we had this late night sitting, we'd sit really late, and kind of extra sitting, you can kind of... So there was no end to the sitting, you sat as long as you could, and I'd be sitting there, they haven't gone to bed yet, so I'm not going to go to bed. I said, they're a little longer. Why don't they go to bed? God, I wish they'd go to bed. Who do they think they are, I'm going to show them who the real Zen student is. there was no real Zen student with those kinds of thoughts. They might as well have gone to bed. But I was looking good. But so don't do it for those reasons. But you might decide that for your own, for good purposes, that it's actually valuable to hang in there with that pain and not give in to it, not avoid it, but to be there and stick through it within reason. Use your common sense. Don't hurt yourself. But there can be a lot of physical pain sitting on retreat and sitting in meditation, which is not going to hurt you, not going to cause damage. And hopefully you can discern the difference. The mindfulness that you use will study the pain and see the difference between what's damaging and what isn't. And it's really appropriate sometimes to say, okay, I'm going to work with this. I'm not going to like it. It's going to tire me out. It's going to be unpleasant. But I think it's for the greater good. It's for my greater benefit. If every time that there's discomfort, when you meditate, you avoid it, I don't think you're really engaged in the Buddhist path. Then the meditation is just a way of feeling good, self-comforting or self whatever. Sooner or later, sometimes it's very valuable to avoid pain. Sometimes hanging in there with the pain is the wrong thing to do. But, over a lifetime of being a meditative person, there are definitely times when the right call is to hang in there with it and work with it. So on one hand, there's situations where you want to just avoid the pain and do something, fix the environment, fix the situation if you can. Then there's situations like on meditation where you might decide that you could fix it, but you're not going to. You're going to hang in there and work with that for all the reasons I've told. And then there's situations where the pain, there's nothing you can do for it. You can get up, you can change your posture, it's chronic pain in your life. The doctors haven't been able to help. Sometimes there are people who have chronic pain where medicine can't really help. Sometimes they come to meditation retreats then. They come to learn mindfulness-based pain help because nothing else helps. And then the first thing we tell them is, feel your pain. And then they get angry, because feel my pain. This is where I'm supposed to get relief from it. But there are times when the pain is chronic. We can't, there's nothing we can do for it. Sometimes mindfulness can be very helpful in that situation to study the pain. Because maybe if you really study it carefully, you find there are small things you can do. My back went out, I had to really study the back pain carefully, really be there for it. Because I was really present for it, I could walk in a way that didn't make the pain worse, didn't injure myself more. And actually, I could walk in a way that actually made it better. But I had to be very, very attentive and walk very slowly. If we pay attention to the pain, you can perhaps learn better ways of living with it. That maybe certainly don't make it worse, but maybe actually make it better if you study hang in there with it. But sometimes it doesn't even do that. There's no guarantee that you're going to die a pain-free life, even though they have morphine now they can give you as people are dying. But, is there value in even really intense, pain? The Buddhist tradition suggests that there is. If you choose to see it that way, if you see it as something you can practice with, and that means for all the functions that I gave you, and there's more, reasons why you might want to open to the pain. So if you have no choice but to experience pain, maybe you can reformulate your relationship to it to see that it has some meaning, some purpose, some function in your practice, in development of compassion, of concentration, of freedom, of purification. And I would venture forth so far, it's a little bit of a superstitious thing to say, I think, because how can I prove this? But my belief is that no matter how intense the pain is always purifying. And the experience of working with pain is that if you can purify yourself in the context of the pain, or all the extra stuff, the extra baggage, the reaction, the fear, the aversion, the tightening and the tension around the pain, if you can work with all that and really learn how to be really fully connected to the pain gets transformed to something else. And the pain is not pain anymore in the same way. That pain itself is a process, not a thing. And if you bring really careful attention to the process level of the pain, then the pain will be seen as movement, as energy that's moving, as pulsing, as sparking. You'll see it as different sensations. Sometimes it can feel like just very, very intense vibration that's flowing. And it's often when the pain starts to feel more like something that's flowing or in process, it feels much more manageable. And in fact, it can actually sometimes not feel like oppressive pain anymore at all. It can feel healing to feel at that level at times. I've never done this. What I'm about to tell you, I've never done, so maybe I shouldn't even tell you this. But but I've known people who've done this, either because they did it in their practice, or because they did it because they had no other choice. They had such intense physical pain. And that is, but it happens most often when people are practicing with this kind of pain. There's a practice in Thailand called, what's it called?
Thailand?
No. Sometimes it's called determination sitting. It's the practice of sitting for 24 hours without moving. And, you know, usually it's these young guys that do it. But it's something people do. And I've met people who've done this. I tried it. And I got to 5 hours. And I sat unmoving for 5 hours. And I broke into sweat, and it was pretty intense. And I just finally gave up after 5 hours. But the people who've done it and seen it through, there's a way of this pain builds and builds and builds, and gets, you know, everything is just on fire. And because, I guess some people could faint at some point, the pain gets strong enough. But because the mindfulness is so strong, and because that's what the practice is, at some point there's some kind of transformation happens in the psyche, some kind of change, some kind of maybe very radical letting go, giving up, very thorough, where the person gets kind of propelled into a whole different realm of consciousness, of being, of life. And some people say it's very, you know, very, you know, they say it's very transformative, very powerful to have this experience. Very significant in their lives to have done that. I'm not recommending this to any of you. I'm not even recommending you try it like I did. But there are times when in your life when maybe you can't do anything for your pain. And at those times, you might remember those Thai monks who sit for 24 hours without moving. And you're being, you know, maybe there's no medicine, nothing the doctors can do for you. And you have that kind of pain. Oh, those guys, those monks, they did this voluntarily. And when they really hung in there with it, and really stayed with it, and really focused on it, something other radical happened with it. Maybe this pain that I have no choice about, that's so intense, maybe I can do the same thing. Maybe I can try to at least. At least it has some meaning, it has some purpose then. Meaningless pain is maybe really difficult to live with. And most people think that all pain is meaningless. But there's a certain level of meaning we give to it, the pain, by our understanding of how we can work with it and what function it has. Does that make sense? I once drew up a list of reasons why you should, why we can open to pain, why we should open to pain, or the usefulness of opening to pain. One is that numbing ourselves or avoiding the pain sometimes can cost us our aliveness. It can kind of dull the body, the being, the psyche. And a lot of people avoid pain, psychological pain, physical pain, by numbing themselves, turning away, avoiding, denying. And the cost is a loss of vitality, a loss of understanding of themselves, and a loss of capacity of paying attention, being sensitive to the world. So numbing is not good. The opening pain means we develop the sensitivity, staying sensitive and alert. We open to the pain to allow the process of meditation to flow uninterruptedly. If you run away from the pain or say no to it or get lost in fantasies, then you've interrupted the process of the meditation. One of the things we're trying to do in meditation is to have a continuity, continuously being mindful through time or whatever arises. And if pain is what has arisen, then that's where we require to develop the continuity. Pain can be a tremendous aid for developing concentration. And that was one of the things I learned when through my practice. You can get very concentrated. It's very compelling to be with pain. And you can really get into it. Someone said it earlier today, right? It was a lot easier to get concentrated, to be present with the discomfort than it was with the comfortable sensations. Pain can be very helpful for concentration. So I went to my Zen teacher and said, I noticed this. And I said, sitting in full lotus is painful. Should I just sit in full lotus to really get the pain early so I can really get concentrated? And he said, don't do that, Gil. Just sit in the way that, is balanced and upright, and don't go looking for trouble. Don't go looking for pain. But when the pain comes, then don't avoid it. Those instructions I got. So pain can be a source of developing concentration, which is often quite helpful. I've known meditators who then become addicted to the pain, or when the pain goes away, finally, after some time, they disoriented because they don't know how to practice anymore because they always depended on the pain to get concentrated. So then they have to learn a different way. You don't want to depend on pain, but you also don't want to avoid it. And certainly you can understand that pain is a good place for developing concentration when it arises. And oddly enough, for some of us, if the concentration gets strong enough, you can actually develop joy while you're focusing on the pain. Because one of the things that arises as a byproduct of strong concentration is joy. Does that kind of seem like a contradiction in terms, to have pain and joy? Pain is a great place to cultivate insight, understanding, as I talked about. Pain can clarify what's most important for us in our lives. All the extra superficial motivations or more shallow motivations we have are, burn up. And what's really important in the context of being with pain? I've known people who've had great physical illnesses and injuries, and after they've struggled with it for a long time, have been really grateful to it because it reorganized their priorities, their values. As I said, it also working with physical pain helps us then to learn how to work with other discomfort, uncomfortable areas in our lives. It develops compassion because it's a universal human experience. So a lot of these things are repeating what I said already. How do we work with pain? It was already 4:30 and I'm talking about that. So all I'm talking about so far has just been a kind of a cheerleading session about that. It's useful to be with pain. There's a lot of different ways to work with pain. And as you're kind of in this practice, you might start acquiring a large repertoire of different techniques and ways of working with pain. Because different kinds of pains, different circumstances require different kinds of ways of being with it. Sometimes it's just a pure vipassana way, just bring mindfulness to it. sometimes it's appropriate to avoid pain, actually, if there, even though I've been giving all this emphasis on paying attention to it. Sometimes the right strategy with pain is to avoid it and come back to it later. Sometimes the right thing is just to be with your breathing and breathe into the pain. Sometimes the right thing is to just be in the edges of the pain. Sometimes the right thing is to be with your relationship to the pain rather than the pain itself. Sometimes the right thing is to be right in the middle of the pain, zero in on it really tightly, really precisely. Sometimes to be very global about the pain. There's a whole bunch of ways to work with pain. And your job as a meditator is to begin exploring these various options and learning what's useful for you, what helps you develop concentration, clarity, what helps you develop equanimous presence with the pain when it's there, what helps you get into it really deeply to transform it into a whole other realm of that maybe you can't imagine right now. So I'm a little bit apologetic of bringing up this big topic without enough time to kind of go into it more. But I hope what I said so far is helpful. I think that a day on mindfulness of the body should include some section about pain, since that's a very common thing to work with. And hopefully your meditation practice will also give you occasion to work with mindfulness of joy, physical joy in the body, rapture. It's also a possibility that comes. Is there anything anyone wants to ask briefly that you would like to ask? I want to leave you kind of unfinished. Or yes?
I'm just kind of curious as to how to put this in the context of the middle way. It seems to me that the Buddha spent some time arguing that pain did not remove defilements, that it did not remove bad karma, arguing against the ascetics of his time who believed that it did, and who cultivated pain for practice.
The middle way is you don't go looking for it. But if it comes, then you work with it within reason. And what he was talking against was not so much that it purifies defilements, but the idea that it purifies the karma in some permanent way. But I don't know. It seems pretty obvious to me that our certain level of our karma is purified by working with pain, working through it. If I have tension in my belly, and I bring attention to it and hold my attention to it, and it softens as a result, that's burning through that karma of at least the surface of that tension or that fear that caused it. But it might not deal with the roots of it. But there's a certain level of purification that comes with concentration practice and mindfulness practice. It's called the path of purification, after all, this path.
I guess the image that I seem to remember reading, just this clenched mouth, the indomitable will that the Buddha spoke of, sounded a lot like someone just really butting heads with pain.
Probably most of the time it's not useful to kind of grit your teeth and butt heads with it. But there might be occasional times in your repertoire of things if you can use with pain, there might be occasional times when actually doing something like that is the right thing. Yeah.
Just a brief comment. My father died of cancer 3 years ago, and he refused to take any morphine or anything that would dull his mind and basically live an ibuprofen, which seems to be like nothing. But I really saw a change in him. I saw him 3 times. And just his heart opening, became very compassionate. And he always was, but even more so, it just radiated.
The general advice that's given in the Buddhist circles about dying is that to try to keep the amount of morphine and things to the minimum. Most Buddhist teachers I know don't. American Buddhist teachers won't come straight out and say don't take anything at all, but they say try to keep it to a minimum so that you can remain conscious as possible. Because you need to be conscious in order to practice, and practice is considered so important. And so, can you you know, keep the amount of sedative to a level that keeps you able to keep practicing with it all. So maybe that's enough. And I appreciate this day. I appreciate all of you staying here and hanging in and engaging so well with the practice. It's a wonderful thing that people find value in this form of engagement with themselves and practice. And it's not always easy. I appreciate how well you all sat. And and may the benefit and merit of this day of practice together, may it be shared with all beings everywhere, and may you take these benefits and carry them with you out into the street as you leave here. And whatever benefit, and you've all benefited some way or other, imagine you're giving it away to the people you encounter as you leave here, or sharing it with them, wafting it out into this other traffic, the cars driving, and you know, may you be happy too, so that you don't just, not just for yourself, but you really have a sense that you're doing this for others also. What else to close? So there's Dana baskets out there by the door. And also, we could probably use about, it'd be very helpful if maybe some 6 or 10 people would stay behind to help tidy up the place. We have the bathrooms to clean, the trash to empty, and we like to vacuum this floor after a day. So if you could talk to either Jeff here, and he'll tell you what to do. And since we want to vacuum in here, make sure there's no cushions left in here. You can put them all on the chairs in the social hall there, so we can vacuum right away. And many, many thanks, and see you soon.